discussion of laws about youth.
All right, so today I will talk about the juvenile justice system and the role of age in different legal systems. And first of all, I would like to start about why I chose this topic and why I structured the paper the way I structured it. So there were several reasons why I've chosen this topic. First, I prepared actually for another paper, which was about Human Rights Watch. And they just recently released several videos about the bad prison conditions in California for youth offenders. So I got interested into that because, as I wrote in the paper, simultaneously in Austria, there were the same discussions. So I thought myself, well, there are two different legal systems, the Austrian one and the Californian state law, and they have, for example, the common law, the civil law. So how come that they have the same results, that they are struggling with the same results? So I wanted to find out similarities and divergences about that. And furthermore, then I remembered in Latin class that we have in Austria, we have completely the same age steps, like from 0 to 7, from 7 to 14, and from 14 to 18 in our contract responsibilities. So I wanted to find out the origins about that. That was the reason why I've started with the historical background in Latin law and Athenian law. And the last, I added the other legal systems, the Gypsy law, law in the Imperial China, and Islamic law, because I came across during the preparation for this class that there were several age marks, especially in the marital age. And coming to the marital age, I'm sorry, I think that on the online paper of my work, the table was lost for the average age for the first marriage. And I only wrote that they are quite young in the Islamic law, and I wanted to specify that. In the final paper, there will be another table of the average age of the first marriage in Austria and in California, which is for Austria in 2012, women married with 29.8 years, and in California, they married with 25.2 years, and compared to them, only four Islamic countries are comparable to the Californian one and to Austrian average age for the first marriage.
Trying to look at how that had changed over time.
Yes, I also made that a remark for the final. They're like, for every year, they're like for 0.3 years older the steps. But I will make the remarks in the final. So what I wanted to emphasize here is also the remaining of the Roman institution of the dispositive capacity, which I think is really interesting because I think in the paper it looked as if it is only in the Roman chapter. But when we look at it in more detail, we find out that in every system we find this dispositive capacity. So what is actually dispositive capacity? It is the full bundle of rights which is received by a person by becoming a certain years of age. And this dispositive capacity is gained because the society thinks that at this time of your life, you are seen as minded. But what does minded mean? After preparing for this course, for this paper, I think that there are several approaches that can be combined in this minded. Because when you look at it, there are three things, like a triangle. You've seen the biological approach, the social approach, and the emotional approach, I think. And the biological approach, I think, is the most obvious one. It's when your body is, for example, able after the puberty, you're able to produce your descendants, right? So I think, but not only the marital age is referred to the biological approach, but also, for example, when you understand what your behavior, what you're acting, make that your brain understands the results of it. So if you hurt someone, you have criminal responsibility.
Is that biology?
I would think so. But also the social one is the next step I want to come to. So the social approach is when you understand in a society and you don't want to be dismissed by your society and also you don't want to lose your reputation. So you know you have to behave in a certain manner that society doesn't dismiss you, right? So as I come to your example, for example, is that when you're invited by your neighbor, you would never take a check or a cash. You bring a wine or a gift or invite him over the next time. So you understand the social environment you're living into. And then there's the emotional approach as well. So you have a certain emotional maturity to understand and to be capable of living in certain things. For example, when you see you have a family, you should be, or you should have a certain emotional maturity in order to be able to support your family and your children. And you would maybe think that the social and the emotional approach is getting more and more into contemporary legal systems, but personally, I don't really think so. Because when we look at the Athenian law, there is the age mark of 17, right? And you could say, well, they could maybe marry under 17. They could just live in the father's house. But I think in order to become your own curios, in order to be able to support your own family, the Athenians already thought, I mean, this is my own opinion, maybe it's different, but they had to be like social and emotionally able, the Athenian men, to have their own and to support their own families. So I think the emotional approach and the social approach is already seen in the Greece, in the Athenian law, sorry. And also when we look at the ancient Rome and into the ancient Rome, into the legal system there, we find that the dispositive capacity is a full bundle of the rights of the jus connubium, which is the right to marry, then the jus commercium, which is the law of the right to enter into business and transaction, and the jus honorum, which is the right to hold a political office. And all these rights were earned with 18. But except one thing, you have it with 25. You have a curator, which is.
But at 60, you can still be under your father's power.
Yeah, I wanted to come. Right. Okay, so first I wanted to go into this age mark with 25. So you have these rights earned with 18, actually, and you have still a curator with until 25, because this curator is looking up that no one. Is taking advantage of you when you are entering business transactions. And when you, again, look at the Austrian system, the only age mark which remains is the age of 25 to become a jury member. Because I thought that was so, because I didn't know that before. And it's like this, that the society thinks that we want to have fair trials, so we don't want to have the other jury members to maybe take advantage of the younger one and to influence their opinion. So you see also the emotional, the social approach that you have to have your, like, strength for your own opinion, kind of. And there is also, in the Roman law, you can say, like you mentioned, in the pater familias, and the power of the father, until he's actually dying. But there is also another way, it's the emancipation, and this could be with there was a kind of a legal trick. This was the adoption. So they enforced, or developed, some kind of a trick. So the father said, well, to close friend or whatever, well, could you maybe say that this is your son? Then the other person said, well, this is my son, and the father didn't count the claim. And then after this worked, the friend released the man from his power. So this man was then free from the pater potestas.
There was a different trick that was used.
Okay.
I didn't know about your one, but
okay.
Basically he sells him into slavery three times, theoretically.
Uh-huh.
And there's
okay.
a phrase in the
okay.
law which says that if you sell your son three times, he's now out of
yeah.
your power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm aware of this one, and also that one I mentioned is
rather
very...
like the Islamic triple divorce.
Yeah, and I think this one is also interesting because you only need one transaction, more or less. So
but nonetheless, if you don't do these things,
mm-hmm.
the son is not responsible for his own family, is not legally
yeah.
independent,
yeah.
and therefore does not have the thing that you're arguing that everybody gets an 18.
Yes. So, yeah. So, yeah. So it's introduced to the pater familias. But in theory and theoretically, if the father is dying and the person is 18, he gets all the full bundle of rights. So this to the ancient legal system, but I also wanted to make a point in the contemporary legal systems where you are seen as an adult with 18. This is the same in California state law as also in the Austrian law. But also there, it's like in the Roman law, theoretically, when you get the full bundle of rights, it is when you're legally allowed to marry, to vote, to go to military, to work, and to have legal consent. There are only two age marks, both in California law and in Austrian law, which are differing. which I already mentioned. In Austria, it's 25 for becoming a jury member, and 21 in California for purchasing alcohol. And maybe how you've read in the paper, I wanted to compare the rates, the criminal rates of juvenile offenders in California and Austria. This was kind of surprising for me, at least. But I wanted to check also the criminal rate for drug abuse. And I looked it up for the year 2012, just recently. And I don't really think that the drug abuse is making the double rate in California.
Do you have any idea about the relative rate of crimes committed versus crimes reported to the police or whatever your statistics are coming from?
I looked the arrest rates up, which is, I think it's difficult to compare. Because in Austria, it works like this. You get reported, but you're not getting arrested similarly. You just get arrested when you got convicted. So the arrest rate is, but I can look that up too.
There's a different thing that you ought to be doing. And that is there's something called the ICVS, the International Criminal Victimization Survey. And that's measuring crime rates not by the police statistics, but by a random survey of the population to ask if they've been victims.
Okay.
And that will tell you whether the ratio of the police measure of crimes to the actual crime rate is the same in different countries.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea if it is in this case.
Okay.
But if it turned out that in the U.S. the figure from the victimization survey was 50% higher than the arrest rate, and in Austria it was three times as high, that would suggest that half as many of the crimes were actually reported in Austria.
That would be interesting.
So that's something you ought to look at.
Yep.
Otherwise, it's very hard to know if you're really doing it apples to apples.
Yeah, or just that they did. Yeah. Yeah, but however, the percentage in Austria was 13% for drug abuse, also including alcohol abuses, and in California it was 14.4%. So it's really just a slightly difference at 1.4%. And also it has to be mentioned that there is no medical marijuana use allowed in Austria, whereas it is in California. So these were actually my remarks to my paper.
Do you have conclusions? That is, it seemed to me that you gave lots of facts. But what I wanted to find were patterns, and that you've got data across a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at it, you've got data for single societies over time. You can see how these things vary for the U.S. or vary for Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And you have various sort of throwaway comments about maybe it's because of this or that, but I've never had a feeling that you would really reach the conclusion, here is why. I mean, take the very simplest case, which is that the age of adulthood in all of the modern societies is substantially higher than it is in lots of historical societies.
Yeah.
So if you look at the Jewish example, for example, where it's 13 and a half for boys, and I think 12 or 12 and a half for girls, and I think the typical medieval rule was somewhere around there. I haven't checked that one. And here you've got a California, you're not supposed to have sex till you're 18. Marriage is 16 or 18, somewhere around there. Other things, 18 and above. So it seems to me that one of the things you ought to be looking at is trying to figure out, did California 100 years ago look more like ancient Europe? What changed between then and now? What changed between, you do a little bit between the Roman and the Greek trying to figure it out. But you see to me that that's that the interesting part, sort of the first stage is gathering the data. But the interesting part is trying to figure out if there's any pattern to it. I couldn't tell if there was.
Okay, so we'll try to do
what
you said in the time.
I'm not an expert in juvenile dependency law. I don't know if anyone here has studied that, but I think that California, a few years back, passed AB 12, which gives children that are dependents of the court the right to stay dependent until they're 25 and receive services up until 25, because I guess the research showed that the rate of recidivism for them was really high. So instead of being like an independent adult at 18, they can remain dependent.
How do they become dependent? Do they have a choice of whether to be dependent?
Yes, it's a choice, and they basically opt in to this
program. Can any child do this? Or it's
no, it's the parents. It's the parents that decide whether
it's children that are dependents of the court, so rather than being dependent
of the
parents.
Of the how do they become dependents?
Their parental rights were terminated
So these are children where child welfare people or somebody said the parent is unsuitable, they're now dependent of the court. And changed was that it used to be the case that this status ended at 18.
Mm-hmm.
And now, in theory, you can end it at 18. Congress day till 25.
Yeah, if I thought that we would either be working full-time or like being school full-time.
In order to opt out?
In order to stay in the program.
To stay in the program.
Yeah. But I thought it was interesting that it's like a shift higher. Like
that seems a lot. You think if you're working full-time,
they
you're
get a stipend of money.
What?
The thing they get, $800 a month.
Ah.
So they either be working with that money.
And they get $800 a month, and what control does the court have over them? Is there anything, other than a disguised subsidy?
Well, they all have, I think, CASAs and, you know, child advocates as well. So if you are not fulfilling those obligations, they can terminate you as a program, and then you're on your own. So.
And what are your obligations?
School or work, and you have to be checking in with your CASAs.
And what?
Your child advocate, so it's kind of like a social worker.
I just thought that was interesting, like it's a trend in California toward making
So for Islamic law, it seems like the threshold for marriage and all that is puberty.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that also
it isn't actually. If you read the Islamic law text that I have a link to, that was one of the two things we're supposed to be reading from, it makes it pretty explicit that it's possible not only to have but to consummate marriage before puberty.
I
think it's after puberty. I think maybe the point at which it requires the woman's consent. I'm not certain about that. Aisha is the one people are always quoting. And it's worth noting that her father is Umar, who was the second caliph, who was a very, very close supporter of Muhammad's. And the she and Muhammad seem to have been very close as far as you can tell from the traditions. But as far as I can tell, at least, the law does seem to contemplate the possibility of marriage before people.
Okay, but what about for other things like crimes, contracts, things like that? I mean, does puberty actually, is that dispositive over those other legal things?
You mean now in Islamic law or in general?
In Islam.
Well, in the other legal systems, I try to focus more on the marital age. So I'm not really aware.
If you want to answer the question, there is a link in the syllabus, I think, and probably elsewhere on the webpage, to the something of the traveler. Where the traveler is really a human being traveling for life, it's not a literal traveler.
Oh.
Which is I'm trying to remember which school it is, but the treatise from one of the schools that somebody has kindly webbed an English translation, and you can actually look through it and see what the rules are, and that might give you the answer to the question, because I don't remember what the contract rules are. It did strike me, though, the whole business of beneficial transactions, that also shows up in Irish law, that there are all of these rules about who can cancel somebody else's contracts. Under what circumstances can a husband cancel the wife, or the wife cancel the husband, or the father cancel the son, or the son cancel the father's contracts? And for some of those categories, the ones you can't cancel are the ones that are clearly beneficial. So in that sense, that's a category which is showing up. Now, that's the obvious problem. It requires an outside person to decide whether you wouldn't have signed it if you didn't think it was beneficial.
Did that have any Greek law as well? If like an elderly parent made a non-beneficial contract, then like the woman of the household.
I don't know.
Okay.
Maybe
I'm missing that.
Again, we have the source. That is the book we have on Athenian law. Athenian law is Greek law. Athenian law. One city in Greece. But for Athenian law, we do have a detailed account of that book. So it's certainly in the library if you don't have a copy of your own. So you can look up and find out. I mean, that's part of the fun of it. We kind of have the sources and entries. Other questions?
So I was wondering, one of the things you can look at is you see the age rise in this society. If you can look at the economics, or if this is harder for somebody to support a family. So you need to, you know, for our society, it's hard to be financially independent at an earlier age, right? But also with regards to our own society, I'm also wondering, from a psychological and emotional maturity standpoint, whether the prevalence of more schooling has to do with that kind of thing. Because what schooling does is that it kind of locks in a lot of individuals with their peers. So they don't really they aren't really exposed to people who are a little bit more older than they are.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's harder for them to mature as fast. So I'm wondering if that could also split our society in how all these industrialized societies, which also closed down adopted public schools, and separate workplaces that they go to parents with home, if that pushes the age of adulthood to 18.
Another point which might be worth thinking about is whether contraception affects any of those. That on the face of it, you would think that we would be less worried about child sex than people were 300 years ago, because it is not nearly as likely to produce babies as it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, if anything, it's the other way around. We've been pushing the age of consent to sex up, not down.
Mm.
So I had kind of a specific question. So you're saying that in Austria, children, youth are put in the same prison as the adults?
Yes.
Correct. And so, and the age of their criminal responsibility is 14.
Mm-hmm.
So if they commit a crime when they're younger than 14,
exactly,
are they not liable at all?
They are not liable. This is kind of difficult to explain, but I will try. No. So when you're committing a crime, it depends on the seriousness. But first of all, the judge, what does he do? He looks at the parents, if they have infringed their parental observation duties. If that's the case, the parents are liable for the case, and additionally, it's also an own offense, criminal offense.
When you say they're liable for the case,
here,
you mean that they get whatever the penalty would have been if they committed the crime themselves.
Yeah.
So if your kid's shoplifts, you go to prison as if you were a shoplifter.
Yeah.
And in addition, you get a punishment for having not monitored
your kid. Yeah, so you should really watch for your children. Yeah, yeah, that's the case.
And does that happen in fact? Does the parents actually spend significant jail terms as a result?
I looked it up because I was interested to that. And
you might someday be a parent.
Exactly. So what happens the most times is that when 15-year-olds go out and drink too much alcohol, the parents are getting convicted for that. So that's really...
For what?
For drinking without... Because,
for drinking, not for neglecting their kids.
Additionally, for that too.
And what is the penalty for that?
It's actually it's only paying amount of money, so it's not a prison crime. But I thought it's like weird if you first you let your children go out and they drink too much and then you're liable first because you didn't observe your children correctly and then you have to pay another thing. Because
what was striking me about it is that we tend to think... I think of prison sentences much more than of fines as having a sort of a moral weight, that you're going to prison means you're a bad person, in a sense. I don't feel nearly as strongly about fines in that regard. But it also, at least to my moral intuition, I'm much more inclined to think you're a bad person if you stole than if your kids stole. And if your kids stole, well, you weren't a very competent parent, but that's not the same thing as you went out and chose to steal. Which is why I was wondering whether in that system you in fact got the same treatment of the parent as if the parent had committed the crime. If an ordinary adult shoplifts, will he go and is caught? Does he go to jail?
No.
Fine. What's the lowest crime for which people actually go to jail?
To jail. If you hurt someone on purpose or...
Assault.
Yeah.
So if your child beats up somebody, some other kid, does the parent go to prison?
Yes.
And do you know of such cases?
I'm not aware of how many there are, but there are for sure.
They do happen.
Yeah, they do happen.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Because in the U.S., parents aren't liable for the torts of crimes with their child. So it seems...
Well, for the torts either?
No, definitely not the torts. I actually was more sure about the torts than the crimes.
What about the tort case in Austria? If your child commits a tort, are the parents sued?
Can you make a specific case?
Sure. Your child breaks somebody's window accidentally.
Oh, yes. Yeah, then you have to... there are only fines for that. So you just...
Well, that would be a damage payment.
Damage payments are also referred to the parents then.
Any mechanism by which parents can divorce their kids if they're in
trouble? Not really, no. I mean, you can give them for adoption.
Heinlein somewhere has a throwaway line in one of his novels about somebody who divorced his parents.
Yeah.
And was thus an emancipated.
Yeah.
I was going to say you had said that they had to violate a legally established duty first, though. So there is some... there is some, the parent
yes.
has to have been found to have violated some legal duty first.
Yes.
So there is some.
So what if, so wait a minute, so suppose your kid commits, your 13-year-old commits a crime, and it turns out it wasn't in any sense your fault. You had taken all reasonable precautions, but the kid had sneaked out anyway.
Then you're fine.
Are you still liable?
That's the second thing a judge has to examine. So the first step is always, are the parents liable? If they are not, you go back to the child, and then the judge has to decide if the kid was mature enough to see whether it was right or wrong. And if he was, so if he was mature enough, then a really weird thing happens to personally for me. So they look at the person who was hurt or the property, the owner who was hurt actually, and you look at the kid. And you make a decision who is actually poorer or richer. So if the kid is hurt more because it's a really poor kid and he cannot afford in any, or the parents cannot, because actually the parents have to pay it again because the kid doesn't have any income. So he just looks at who is richer and who can survive the damage more or less. So this is really the ultima ratio for it. And it's not really happening often, but it's happening. I am aware of one case where a 10-year-old boy, there is a legislator that you have to go together with your children to school and pick them up until the age of 10. It's like the legislator. It's like a little bit like case law. And after 10, it's fine when they go alone to the bus and go back. So if something actually happens on the way to the bus or back, it's actually not a breach of parental control, right? So in this area, when there's something happening, and this boy throws a little stone on an old woman, and she just fall on the floor, and her dress was ripped apart. And it turned out that she was a poor old woman who didn't even have a house or whatever. So they said, well, okay, actually, there wasn't a parental breach of the observation, but it's really no big deal for you to pay for a new dress. So this was referred them to.
What about, imagine that in the same situation, a 13-year-old assaulted another kid and injured him. That's an offense which you say can put you in prison. Does the 13-year-old go to prison?
The 13-year-old, no.
Parents can't go to prison because the parents were not responsible.
It depends then if it happens in a school, because when it happens in the school, the teachers are reliable for that.
How about in the case where it happened at a point when no adult was theoretically responsible?
I would say then it's the decision of the judge. I'm not aware of what would happen exactly, to be honest. And I'm not aware of any case like this.
But I was a little curious, just sort of in passing, you mentioned something called the victim-offender mediation. I was wondering what that was.
Mm-hmm. I came across that also when I looked at the Australian and Canadian law, because they have kind of the same. And it's like a choice. You can opt in. But it is referred, so at the first step when a juvenile offense, when the judge sees...
This is only for juveniles?
Yeah, it's only for juveniles. And when they decide, it's referred, and when they decide to do it, then first everything is tried to decide it out of the court. So it's also, they're also thinking about on the hurted people, so they can address directly to the juvenile offenders, and they are not... Like, because when you have a court that breast is allowed to come there, and they can allow Diarra to make pictures, and it's, like, for the reputation also quite badly if something really bad happens. I mean, sure, the reputation is always, like, bad if you did something bad. But if it's out of court, there are no breasts, there are no pictures.
But then what does happen out of court? Does it end up with a penalty on the offender?
It depends on what they agree on. So it can happen that they are only agreeing on damages.
And what if they don't agree? Does it go back to court?
Then it's going back to court, yeah. So it's kind of an alternative dispute resolution.
Because after all, if you look at the Islamic system for assault and killing, the victim can agree with the offender that the offender will pay him some amount lower than the fine that would be set by the law, and that then settles it. So in that sense, it's analogous to that arrangement.
Mm-hmm. Except that there's a third party still in the room. So they're not alone, they're...
Yes. but they get to decide.
They get to decide.
Is there, I don't know that much about criminal law, is there a movement in the United States toward victim offender mediation? Like, I thought I saw something about that.
I would do, I dare definitely doubt it. I mean, it doesn't seem like that anyway. I mean, like, that was just in the DA's office over the summer.
Not that it's, like, in place, but, like, that it's something that people are talking about in the field.
So do you have any theory about why the gypsies have early marriage? The only thing you say is because you need to be married to be in the CRIS, but that's their decision. They don't have to do it that way.
Yeah, well, first I also think that the biological reason is also here. And actually, I would say that the biological reason is the main one. And you can also, especially in the Gypsy law, there are no birth certificates or whatever, so they are not really clear age marks when you're allowed to do that, and that's it's difficult to find them out here. So I think that's maybe why
Is it possible that one of the patterns is that societies where having children is a good thing tend to marry women young in order to use more of their reproductive life? And if you think about the fact that one of the really big differences between now and even 200 years ago is that we have essentially zero infant mortality. Not literally zero, but it's not a significant factor. Whereas in most past societies, a sizable fraction of all infants died within the first year or two. And that meant you had to produce more children to maintain your family, and that might mean that it was more important to marry women young.
Yeah, maybe I find a read about that, too.
Don't know. It just seems to be the part of what would be interesting would be to, in this paper, and for that matter, the other papers as well, is to see whether there are patterns. There may not be. You can't figure out what's going on. But having observed the data, it's nice.
Other people have questions on this?
Okay. Then we have our next.
Hey guys. So I did. So I examined some ancient civilizations, cultures, and I tried to look at their management of environmental resources. So let's start thinking of what these things are, right? So we have the sun over here, and the sun's kind of a given. It's kind of like nature's free lunch, you know? It just kind of comes down, provides all this energy. And then down here on Earth, we basically have a few things that are, you know, essential. Water is one. Land or soil is another. And, you know, sun, water, and soil, that's
awesome. Air.
Air is great. Air is good. We do a lot of regulation of air in modern day, but, you know, they didn't really care back then, so. Because they just, I guess, had plenty of clean air or didn't have the science down or whatever. Or at least I didn't come across anything where they were regulating clean air or air pollution. Anyway, so my paper essentially focuses on what people did with this. And one other extremely important resource in the ancient world were trees. Lumber. They used them a lot for shipbuilding, building houses, building everything. I mean, trees also provide ecosystem services. So, let's say you have a mountain over here and you have a bunch of trees on it, right? And there's a river flowing down right over here. Well, these trees are providing service. They're holding up dirt. They're basically making this mountain stay in this shape. Once you cut down all the trees and then a big rain comes, a bunch of this dirt goes into the river, and then it causes all sorts of problems. And, you know, in modern times, dirt often holds pollutants that are kind of sequestered in the dirt. And once they erode...
You might consider that one of the most famous ancient civilizations was exactly the opposite of the story you're telling. Egypt, where it was the flooding of the Nile that kept the land fertile.
It was the silt. Yes, that's true.
Anyway, continuing. This strikes me as...
That is interesting.
It's interesting for a much more general point, and that is that people... There's sort of a prejudice in these discussions that change is bad. And that's not the right prejudice, that you can describe a change which is bad, but change is change. It's not as bad, sometimes it's good.
Sometimes, I guess sometimes it can be good. But I'm not sure to what extent the Egyptians increase the...
I don't know if he did anything. I'm only saying that from their standpoint, the fact that the Nile flooded and brought down water, I think, was seen as a good thing, not a bad thing.
It seems like they kind of...
And for that matter, if you think for a moment about what's happening to Louisiana, I don't know if you have any geologists in your family, but my wife is one.
Okay.
And the Army Corps of Engineers, in a certain sense, is destroying the state of Louisiana.
Because they took up from the wetlands.
No, because what normally happens is that the Mississippi brings down mud, and the mud washes back, and that balances the fact that Louisiana is gradually sinking due to accumulation of deposits from the last many million years. The Corps has prevented the Mississippi from changing its mouth. The result is that the delta has gotten out past the edge of the continental shelf, and the result is that all of that silt is being dumped in deep water and not coming back, and the result is that the Louisiana coast is moving north.
Yeah, that's a great example of, you know, mismanagement, basically. Or, I mean, not applying sound ecological principles to mismanagement.
But it's also a case where, if I understand it correctly, the silt that you're describing had been providing a desirable effect, as in Egypt, as opposed to an undesirable effect, as in Venice.
I mean, I guess what it comes down to is that we come onto an environment in a certain state, and to some extent, it's working for us in that state to the extent that we want to live there and use the resources and use the land to live there because it's nice. But then, and then change happens. You're right. Slow change can happen, and it happens. I don't want to say naturally because people get weird about that word, but it just happens, right? So, when people try and stop that change, sometimes it can be bad. Yeah, so I agree with you. Yeah. So trees, extremely important for the ancients. Modern day, we like old. These are more important for us. Oil, aluminum, maybe to some extent lithium. These are basically like the modern day equivalent of trees. Hey, with oil, we don't even really need the sun. Because if we all had to live underground, we could just use lights to grow food and produce oxygen. And we can do almost anything with oil nowadays. But there's only about, they say there's only about 200 years left of it at current rates, so who knows what would happen there. So I started with the Babylonians. And this is a book that I used, and it's actually really cool. I wanted to pass it around because there's some actual original cuneiform, pictures of the cuneiform texts, which I thought was cool. So if you guys want to take a look, you can.
Treat it gently.
It's definitely a very old book, so please treat it gently. The Babylonians, actually, I was surprised to see that they did quite a bit of management. They did quite a bit of land use management. In fact, most of the letters in that book are just decrees from the central government transferring titles of lands from one person to another.
Do you count that as management?
I mean,
defining property rights?
Well, I mean, yeah, I do. I mean, I think land use is definitely
there's a distinction between the government saying you must use the land in this way and the government saying this land belongs to you, now use it as you like. There may be advantages to both, but those are different kinds of activities. And I couldn't tell in the things you were quoting at least, whether what was going on was more than just an allocation of property rights.
But it seems like they're trying to give everyone, in one of the passages it says, so that, like, they're transferring property rights so that they might not sue the palace for their hunger. And it seems like what they've figured out is that not everybody has land. And that the ability to use land, because of the finiteness of the land resource, they have had to kind of manage it or redistribute it in a way so that more people...
It's not clear they're redistributing. It sounds as though the land they're giving away may be there, maybe the king's land.
Sometimes it is. Sometimes in one of the passages, it's the king giving land to the bakers.
Yes.
Seems like a baker's guild or something like that. Whereas the king is like subsidizing the bakers.
How sure are we of the translations, by the way? Because I was struck when I was looking at Hammurabi's code years ago by the fact that two different translations were completely different.
Yeah, I mean, it has a little bit of the linguistic methodology and analysis in the front of the book.
This is the only source you know for this material.
Yeah, this is the only source I use. Yeah.
Because it'd be interesting to see if anybody else has another translation of the same.
I guess I should. Yeah, I guess I should do that. I'm just going to plug in really quick so I can take note of some of the suggestions you're giving me. But anyway, so the Babylonians had more. They didn't just do this passing around of land and managing land in that way. They also had dams and canals and rivers. And they would basically, that depending on where the water was, where the flood was, how much water was in the river, etc., they would erect dams during certain times of year and basically manage water in that way. And their main goal was just to make sure that there would be water sources in like the major cities in the Babylonian Empire. So they also did that. And then one of the most interesting things was that they had to use, they did shipbuilding in ancient Babylonia. They did quite a bit of shipbuilding, and they had to use lumber for that. And they also had to use tarps. But
what are tarps? Did you get that out?
Tarps?
You keep referring to something translated as tarps. Are these tarpaulins? What are they made out of?
I wonder what they're made out of. I thought of them as like a tarp, but I guess our modern day tarps are plastic. Maybe they're made out of hide or something, sheep's hide, leather, I would think. So canvas. Could be canvas. I don't know, but a canvas isn't really waterproof.
It is after it gets wet.
Okay, there you go.
Canvas for tents. So the threads swell when they get wet. That makes it waterproof there.
That could have been it. So, interesting. Okay, so they had a problem because of all the ships they were building with deforestation. They had some severe, pretty severe, they had a ministry of the forest, actually, and they had some pretty severe restrictions on cutting, leasing, basically using the lumber resource.
Whose trees are those? Is that the royal forest?
Yes. The royal forest was the one being regulated, like in a lot of these other things. I mean, in the Islamic context, there was the trees on private property were seen as a common resource, but in most of the other ones, the government is really only allowed to regulate those lands, or I mean, to some extent, those forests which it owns itself. So there's that, and then there's also evidence in one of the passages of them keeping stockpiles of lumber, and
one of the things you want to think about, I think more than you have, is what are the circumstances in which leaving people alone gives the right answer and what are the ones in which it doesn't. So if you think about trees, if trees are on private property, and if we expect that the king is going to want to build ships in 5 years and is going to be willing to pay lots of money for lumber, then we have an incentive to grow lumber ourselves.
Yes.
On the other hand, we don't have an incentive to prevent the Laguna of Venice from filling up. That's a different kind of problem. That trees, in a sense, fits into a private property exchange system, whereas the external effect of silt coming down and filling up the lagoon doesn't fit into it. And I think it's worth thinking about those distinctions. So it makes sense for the king to have rules for regulating his forest. It's not clear, at least, whether it makes sense for him to have rules for regulating other people's forests, except in the Venetian case where the other person's forest is where the mud is coming from.
I mean, unless you think that the king has control over all the trees.
But then the question is, does it make sense for the king to have control over all the trees? He doesn't have control over all the land, right? Babylonia.
No, he doesn't have control.
Wood is even more expensive than wood. More important than wood.
Absolutely, always.
And yet I think Babylonia, I think the land is basically private property. Most of it. Yep. So anyway, you see, there are a bunch of interesting questions to think about. It's about sort of, because one of the questions you want to know is, do they have it right? If they have it right, why do they have it right? But one of the things that struck me reading your paper is that I'm very critical of the idea of sustainability. I think in our society it's a crazy idea that you can't defend. But I'm not sure I'm critical about it for the Babylonians, because the reason I'm critical about it is that sustainability means doing things in such a way you can keep doing them that way forever.
Yeah.
That does not describe our society. Not even close. It is an insane picture of our society to think that in 100 years we'll do most things the same way we do it. But it's not an insane picture of Babylon.
Okay, so you're saying that because of the way we change.
Because our society,
and our
technology is changing rapidly.
Our ability to change.
You certainly want to think about effects. But thinking about it in your interest principle sense only makes sense in a static world. In a world where the resources that you eat up today are resources you're sure you're going to want in 100 years.
But we know which resources we want now.
But we don't know which resources we want in 100 years.
But, can't we think that our children might want the same resources?
Is it likely? Do you think it's really important that we've got lots of grass for grazing horses on at the moment?
It's
that was the transport system a mere 110 years ago. The transport system was horses. Mostly.
But what is important to add to this, what is important, the most important aspect of sustainability, I believe, yes, the technology is going to change, thereby the processes we use are going to change, but the most important thing is the resources. And that would be like the ancient system of crop rotation where crops are redepositing minerals back into the soil that thereby grow the next batch of crops. We want to utilize methods, which I believe is a difficult task, but we want to use methods that are going to sustain our resources.
But we don't know in advance which of the resources we value now will matter in 100 years. That was a thing about grass.
That is true.
Go back for a moment, because we could get into a long argument about our society. The point that struck me as interesting was that the same argument that struck me as unconvincing for us struck me as much more convincing for the society he was looking at, because most past societies were very close-set.
And if you look at that, just across all across history, that seems to be the case, because their development was so much more slow-going in ancient times, and then all of a sudden, just in the last 100 years, it's been...
A little more than 100. Read Marx's. Marx has this wonderful passage about the century of the bourgeoisie and about the amazing things that happened in the course of basically the late 18th, early 19th century, on the whole world revolution.
And it's insane, because it's just such a fast pace.
Anyway, I guess the way I look at it is that, like, we know what we need now. And I guess we know that whoever comes after us could probably function using the same methods that we use to function. As long as there's enough resources left for them to do so that way. So that's basically where I'm coming from.
Yep.
Let's just do the Inca really quick, because I think these people are really cool. The Inca...
Remember, this is supposed to be mostly discussion and not mostly presentation.
Okay, cool.
Well, let's say a little bit about the Inca and then get people to talk.
So here's what the Inca did that was kind of cool. The Inca were just extremely control freaks, right? They would conquer land, and then they would just redivide everything. And they would redivide it into quadrants. So part of it goes to the sun god, which by the sun god, they mean the clerics and the people who ran the whole religious thing. Part of it goes to the Inca, which I think comes back to the capital. Part of it goes to the commoners, the local people, and gosh, what was the fourth quadrant?
Storage,
that's right. So these reproductive goods, you're talking water, you're talking animals, you're talking land, they were divided up into quadrants, okay? And then to be part of the Inca Empire, basically, you had to pay taxes in the form of labor. Labor was to work the land, and it was also to, storage slash welfare, right? Okay, yeah. So it was to work the land, and it was also to improve the roads. The roads were extremely important because they exist in this crazy topography and this crazy geological situation, but they also were extremely efficient at getting things from place to place. So so each area is divided up into quadrants, but then there's also quadrants of the empire, right? And one thing they did with the quadrants of the empire, north, south, east, west, right? And there were governors in each place. And what they did... particularly with the wild animals, was pretty cool. Because normally hunting was legal. You could not hunt wild animals. Normally. Okay, so apparently, a few different sources seem to think that wild animals became extremely docile. And like especially the ancestors of the llama, the wild ancestors of the llama, would just be like in and around the town. Okay, and then once a year, they would go to one quadrant, and thousands of people would partake. And they would gather up animals, like beat animals into a huge circle, and then they would kill as many deer as they needed, and they would release like the best female and the best males, and then they wouldn't kill any of the llamas, but they would just shear them all and then re-release them. So
you get a mildly similar pattern with the Cheyenne. They aren't releasing any buffalo, but they are having a controlled hunt at one time with the whole tribe, where it's illegal to start. I think maybe during the rest of the year, maybe not buffalo separately, but during the relevant period, you're not supposed to attack them until it's announced we're all going in.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Modern day hunting season.
Well, it's not hunting season because this is a mass hunt by the whole tribe. As opposed to the time when people can hunt.
Yeah. But I mean, just the controlled.
It may have been a more efficient form of hunting. Or it may have had other reasons, I don't know.
I mean, I think it might have been just so that they wouldn't deplete all the wild animals. You know, because like
you could do that. You could do that also by hunting continuously during the year with some kind of limitations.
Yeah, I think you could. I think you could.
So,
I think another possible explanation is it may have served a protective interest so that people wouldn't be killed going out by themselves to hunt. So that way,
true.
I don't know. It's just an interesting.
Could be an essence of more efficient form.
Well, then remember they're rotating each quadrant every year. So by the time they come back to the north,
every 4 years they're doing it in any particular place.
Exactly. So it also allows the animal populations to rebound. What's up?
There's a hypothesis that the Amazon is that a contender for you?
Not really.
Oh, okay.
Well, go ahead.
Okay. Well, I was wondering. The idea is that it's just like a really big garden, and the people who were cultivating it were just really technological or agriculturally.
The argument is that the Amazon is not natural.
Really?
So
oh, well, I mean,
human,
you know,
human activity.
That wouldn't surprise me, honestly, because I've heard a lot of indigenous peoples to certain areas. And we think of them more of like gatherers, right? But what a lot of them did was really cultivate or propagate species of plants that they liked to live off of and that they preferred. So, yeah. So, I mean, that's interesting.
Just going along with your point, the Aboriginal Australians said that too. They called it fire farming because they had these huge, tall, weed-like grasses called spinifex, and they had to burn them down because they put nutrients back in the soil, and some seeds used as a fire to germinate.
Yeah, so a lot of indigenous peoples were more like kind of pseudo-agricultural. Maybe there's arguments out there saying that.
Well, that is, we know that the Maya, Inca, and Aztec were all agriculturalists, and that the North Americans mostly were not until a few hundred years before the Europeans arrived, because they didn't have any piece of crops, and the crops that had been developed out of selective breeding, deliberate or accidental, in Central America gradually moved north because it takes time for crops to adapt to changing climates, with the result that the bean, squash, maize combination, which is what basically North American agriculture ran off of, only arrives in the Great Plains area, I don't know, maybe 200 years before Columbus, something like that, but pretty late historically. So those were peoples. And one of the interesting things is that we tend to think of primitive societies as static, as stagnant. And you then realize that the whole lifestyle that we associate with the Plains Indians did not exist until the horses became available and the horses were bought by the Spanish. And the lifestyle they had before that, which was basically very primitive agriculturalists, had only existed for a couple of hundred years. And before that, they were hunter-gatherers, basically. Almost all of them.
So there were changes going on.
So there were changes, not at our rate, but still quite substantial by historical standards.
But the question I wanted to ask about the Amazon was, like, you have the idea where there's something that looks really different than thoughts that one thing is for the purpose of another, something that's really integrated. Is there something you studied that can explain how that could have arisen?
Wait, I'm sorry. You're talking about what?
Something like if the Amazon was a cultivated kind of garden, master garden.
Okay, yeah.
But when you're building a complex ecosystem, that's a lot different from the typical picture of agriculture, where it's like this plot, this year is for clover, then we rotate it, and it's, you know, very compartmentalized. So I'm wondering, is there something you studied that could explain something that's more integrated, more gradual, a lot less clear?
You know, I mean, I kind of in passing saw a lot of agricultural regulations. I didn't really look into those as much. I guess maybe it would have been cool to, but. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, modern-day organic farmers often, like, you know, use biodiversity in their crops, but not to the extent where it's, like, you know, one tree species and then one tree species and one tree species like it would be in the Amazon, you know, like extreme biodiversity in that way. So I don't know how to explain what you're talking about.
I think the description of the Amazon is that I've seen it isn't that they're creating biodiversity, but they're doing things like liquid fires and such to control how the land gets
oh, fires, but, for sure.
But there's a book called 1491 you might want to look at, which is an attempt to reconstruct what the New World was like just before Columbus arrived. And I gather it's a highly controversial issue, that in particular the population estimates that some people are now arguing are much higher than the earlier population estimates. And that's because the question is whether the earlier ones were being biased by the mass die-off due to European diseases. Some people argue that, in fact, the population was like 5 or 10 times as high as estimated, and we don't know. I don't think we know if it's true, but it's an interesting sort of attempt to reconstruct. So,
were we in environmental law together?
Manister? Manister. Did you have Manister?
No. Or were we in the U.S. Supreme Court?
I'm sorry, I don't know.
No, okay. No, that's okay. Okay. So, Tragedy of the Commons, you know here that...
Yeah, it's like the basic argument behind...
Do you know where Tragedy of the Commons really, like, made a presence in terms of molding present environmental law and policy?
Mm-hmm. I mean, just from random...
You mean the phenomenon or the idea?
The phenomenon.
Well, yeah, fisheries. They use, I mean, like, you know, fisheries management is basically based on this concept because fisheries are one of those wild ocean fisheries are one of those resources that, you know, no one pays rent. There's no real...
It's hard to establish property rights in it.
It's hard to establish property rights in it. Private property rights is one of the main ways you can fight Tragedy of the Commons, which is also part of my paper.
But a different way, incidentally, which you also mentioned in Fairwood Societies is by having a commons which actually has rules of access.
Exactly.
So that I like to say that the real English commons that Hardin was supposed to be talking about was about as common as a GM factory floor, because in fact there were communal rules about who could graze what where, because they weren't stupid and they
right.
didn't see the problem.
Exactly.
So the problem really occurs mostly in the context where it's very hard to either have property or effectively regulate.
Mm-hmm.
Which, for example, if you think about whaling, 19th century whaling, all right, it's not all one country. It's people from lots of different countries. It's very hard to regulate. So there's a very interesting book by Bob Ellickson on norms, and he describes the efficient norms that the whalers have worked out among themselves mm-hmm. for dealing with things like what happened when one whaler harpooned a whale and then another one brought it in.
That sounds like something I should include in my paper.
But what he doesn't discuss is how come they didn't have... Why did they keep having to change the norms? Because they keep having to change the species they were hunting. Why did they keep having to change the species they were hunting? Because they were hunting one after another into almost extinction.
Right.
Why didn't they have norms for limited catch? Because that wasn't a system that norms could enforce, essentially. If you're in your job, I've got a piece on that.
Maybe I should have said idea. Like, I'm trying to figure out where it became sort of the basis of environmental policy right now.
I mean, like, I see the abatement of the Tragedy of the Commons in all of these legal systems that I described. So, like, I see it in ancient Babylon, which is, like, one of the first. So, I mean, like, I don't think it's a very new, I don't think it's necessarily a new concept. I mean, it's kind of something that's been around and has justified environmental management regulations and laws since civilization, really. I mean, that's the way I see it, anyway. I mean, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm just having a hard time, like, figuring out how to balance this concept with other
what?
Like, ideas of environmental management, I guess.
Like,
Tragedy of the Commons has the characteristic that in a standard kind of economic value, without introducing any mystical value for trees or anything, you still get the wrong result unless you have some solution for Tragedy of the Commons.
You know, basically the ability to exclude people from using. I mean, you know, so that either comes through privatization or strict government.
But, I mean, what you said earlier was that in a society that continually is changing, it might be irrelevant, right?
Well, it's irrelevant if you're talking about effects for 50 years, but it's not irrelevant if you're talking about effects for 1 year.
Right.
If you think about fisheries,
right,
you're
right.
even overfish in 1 year.
Right.
And so there is a... That in general, dealing with the future, my argument at least would be that bearing costs now for future benefits,
mm-hmm.
it makes less sense for the distant future in a changing society than a state-static society because you don't know what future benefits are going to be. I'm a little reminded of my uncle's description of my mother, his sister, as always saving for a rainy day and living in perpetual drizzle.
Well, yeah, it's funny because the Islamic kind of justification for environmental ethic, basically, was because they wanted to preserve for future generations for posterity.
Except for your quote about the doomsday.
Oh, yeah.
But on the judgment day, you should still plant a palm tree.
It's like, I don't really, I mean, maybe, but like it's not a functional thing.
Okay.
It's a religious or a philosophical thing.
But the other point in your story about Umar,
the old man who's about to die.
That's right. Is that in a well-functioning private property society, Umar doesn't have to give him that advice, because in that society, it would pay him to plant the land and then sell the future crop today in one way or another. You know, if you have secure property rights, it pays to make investments past your own lifespan, because then you can sell those invested things during your lifespan.
Oh, yeah. I guess that's true, as long as it's not like just passing to your son for free or whatever.
Or if you care about your son, you can pass it to him.
So he could have, what you're saying is he could have cultivated his field and then sold it before he died?
It pays in it with secure property rights to plant trees, even if they're going to come to harvest after your death, because half-grown trees are worth more than
yeah, or just, planted trees. Yeah. I guess that's true. Yeah. No, I agree.
But that does depend on, see, one of the other things relevant to analyzing these societies is that does depend on secure property rights. So one possibility, suppose what's really going on is the reason they're having the king grow the trees instead of the individual people is the individual people are bright enough to realize that if they grow the trees, the
king will take
them
anyway.
That's right. So that's one possibility, that you don't have secure property rights, and therefore he has to do it himself.
Yeah.
All sorts of things we're thinking about in terms of making sense of all
no, this. I'm going to have to look into the property rights of these. Like, I think maybe just a blurb about
how well, come in and we can talk more, because there's an interesting set of ideas sort of running around here, which are mostly economics.
Okay. Cool.
Other questions? We get to our next one. Great. Thank you. We'll try.
Sorry, I was
going to
say, I can go really fast.
Well, don't go faster than you have to. You have up to 10 minutes to talk, but then we talk for until we run out of time, basically.
Sounds good. Okay, so I did my paper on Aboriginal Australia. And first, I just want to talk about why I chose to write this paper. I studied abroad in undergrad and had a professor who taught a class on just kind of the history of Australia. And the large portion of the class was about the Aboriginal culture. And one story in particular that he told that really kind of, I don't know, intrigued me was a story about a man and a woman, Aboriginal man and woman, who married within their moiety. And as you know from the paper, that's not allowed. If you have a moiety, you have to marry someone in the context.
I couldn't figure out. Is a moiety just you have some group and you divide it in half? Is that what it means?
Yeah, so I should probably clarify that. So the way it works, they have very strict marriage rules, as you probably gleaned, and I think the main purpose for that was to ensure that people weren't intermarrying. Incest was a big concern for them. But the way the moiety works is you have a tribe or your language group, and a moiety splits it in half. So if you're in group A, you can only marry people from group B. If you have a larger group or a more complex group, you can have sections. That splits it into four. So say, for example, you have groups A, B, C, and D. A has to marry someone from B, and then their child would be C. And then that C has to marry someone in D. Now, the more you go on with this, you can have groups of eight, and so you can see how this works out. Another way of thinking about it is in the section, so the split of four, you, say, are a young, eligible man, and you're looking for your lady, and you are limited in that you can't marry someone from your section, from your father's section or your mother's section. So that very quickly limits that pool. And one of my arguments, and I don't know if it's true or not, is that I thought this would reduce...
And if you have an eightfold group, does that mean that you can't marry one from your grandparents either?
I'm not entirely sure. Once you get to eight, it gets pretty complicated. I mean, there are books truly that are, you know, thousands of pages thick and that are just different tribes, and it has these huge graphs of their moiety systems. But another way you can look at the, or another distinction within the moiety is that it's either determined by your mother or your father. So it's a matrimoiety or a patrimoiety or a fratry, I've also heard it called. But going back to this original story, so a man and a woman, their names, I'm going to butcher this, were Wari and Yatunka, and they married within their moiety, and as such, their clan or their tribe, you know, banished them. So they take off out on the lam. They actually sent people after them to find them and bring them back and administer punishment. But they managed to escape, and this is in 1930. They managed to live on the land as their ancestors had taught them until the 70s. And in 1977, they figured it was probably safe to come back because the elders would have probably passed away or they'd been forgiven. And they're actually considered the last of the nomads, so the last of the true Aboriginal Australians, because they'd avoided not only their own society's detection, but also that of the Aboriginal.
Did they have any children?
They did. And once their sons reach the age of initiation, so essentially age of majority or marriage, like you were talking about in yours, they send them off to live with kin. And I think it's kind of the sins of the mother are not the sins of the child, so they're free to go back. But it was just such an interesting story that marriage laws can have such a strong impact that it would keep you away from your family, which, as you can tell in the Aboriginal society, is very, very important for 4 years. So that's just, sure.
I actually wanted to agree with your point about incest and why they took it so seriously. My incest was saying they come to incest by death.
Yeah.
And I believe that a strong part of that is genetic diseases, and I think that they may have recognized that incest could produce some
undesirable. Didn't the Inca have more or less mandatory incest for the royal? For
the Inca?
I think the Inca royal family is like the Egyptian ancestors, but not the
Oh, I know the Mayans were horribly afraid of incest. Well, they punished it severely because I think a lot of it has to do when it's across cultures in that kind of sense. I think a lot of it is driven by common sense and fear of things that may occur.
It might be, but it's a little bit tricky because incest increases the risk of putting lethal recessives together, but that also means it reduces the number of lethal recessives in the population. When you put them together, they die, and that particular pair disappears.
Ah, they can't.
So it's not entirely clear. My impression is also, at least in modern societies, that the genetic risk for incest is not very high. That it exists, but my impression is I've seen figures, and you're not talking about 50% chance of anything like it. Which makes me wonder if maybe there are other reasons why many differences. Most societies, I think, have rules against incest, but not all.
Well, another reason Mayan had specifically was that it offended the gods. It was a religious crime, and that's why it was.
Yeah, but then unless we believe there's the same set of gods giving orders to everybody,
no,
you have to explain why they give the same orders to different societies.
Well, of course not. It must be some moral.
Must be something.
Response.
It must be something.
Anyway,
continue. I think it also might have to do something with control, because at least in the Aboriginal context, and marriages weren't necessarily just for love. You know, oftentimes you would trade your daughter's hand, even as a small child, in exchange for meat or, you know, some other valued item.
I want to go back to the incest and kind of the idea of like God's punishments, because I'm wondering if it might not be like the same set of gods, the same set of rules, but culture is observed that what happens is that the children of these unions come out of school or she has some sort of problem. And so they think that it's a result of them having done something wrong as to inflict some kind of punishment from whoever is the kind of spiritual authority in the world. And so from looking at that pattern, because, you know, you could try to read out these genes, but that's assuming that they have an understanding of what genes are. So if that's a mechanism, then they might be afraid that not only will this climate has been bestowed on this couple, but also on the rest of society, that it's going to be some kind of magical quantity that's too much of this happening.
The other thing is that even if a single incestuous mating has a low probability, a high frequency of such means that you're getting a more and more uniform gene pool, and therefore the odds are getting higher.
Right.
So that, for example, the Amish have a very high rate of genetic problems because they're heavily an inbred society.
Interesting. I think the Aboriginal people dealt with that in that marriage was always,
exogamous,
thank you. And it was,
but only within the tribe, I gather.
It could also be outside of the tribe as well, though. Oftentimes, if you had tribes that were within the same area and shared the same dreaming or similar spirit tracks, you would have constant kind of interweaving of the people. So it wasn't, you know, specific that you had to stay within your tribe.
What tribe was the child of? You have parents of two different tribes. Do we know whether it's a father, mother, or...
I would assume it's the father because the woman would go and live with the husband's tribe. So a couple other things I just wanted to clarify. I use the term mostly harmonious to describe how the different tribes, acted with each other. And I don't want to give the impression that it was peaceful, because it definitely was not peaceful. Their punishment was harsh, quick, and brutal. One of the quickest ways of dealing with private offenses was spearing the thigh. This is kind of a ceremonial act. Usually, unless you hit an artery or something like that, it wouldn't cause any serious damage. But, I mean, if that's for a small infraction, imagine what it would be if you thought, for example, that one tribe sang or cursed somebody in your tribe and caused them to die. Anytime somebody died in a tribe, it was not ever considered to be from natural reasons. I think this had to do with the very religious context. Everything was tied to religion and tied to the dreaming and the ancestral beings. So if someone died, there had to be a purpose. And oftentimes, if you had tribes in more arid areas where there weren't as many different clans and tribes populating the area, you had suspicions among the different tribes. So if somebody in your tribe died, you assumed it was because somebody else did. So they would often go with their boomerangs and spears and, you know, have, I guess, ritualistic ceremonies that usually ended up with a lot of people dead. So that was one clarification. Another thing I wanted to talk about was the idea of conservation by the clans. I think I made it seem like they were actually going out into the fields and, you know, making sure that things were planted properly or making sure that they weren't overhunting, which was mostly what the hordes did. What the clans did was very much a spiritual conservation of the land. What they felt was that there was some totemic animal that was native to the area where their clan was located, and it was their job to make sure that the spirit of that animal was nourished and fed. So I don't know if that clarifies a little bit more, because you have the horde at the bottom who's the one who's actually going out, doing the hunting and gathering in that specific area. And then it was the clan, which was a much larger group, that saw to the spiritual nourishment.
But in what sense is the horde conserving? That is, do they have institutions by which they, in effect, say, we're short of some animals, we better stop killing them for a while or not?
It was more just not doing anything to excess. It was, I think, kind of like American Native or Native Americans. You know, it was, if you kill something, you use every part of it. With the clan mentality, though, you would often hear of tribes, you know, that could be clear across Australia, who were noticing that there was a low possum population, and they would send someone to that respective clan to then perform the rituals and ceremonies that would increase that population. Usually not, but I think it was their way of dealing with a very harsh environment, because you have extreme.
I'm just curious about whether there were also non-magical, as it were,
yeah,
mechanisms.
Not so much. I think it's just the general nomadic nature.
Now, this totemic animal, is it like a giant monster that lives in the woods?
Not exactly. So a different. So the thing with the Australian Aboriginal culture is that you have layer upon layer upon layer of different classifications. So several different classifications would give you a totem. The most prominent one was the clan. And within the story of the dreaming, you have different spiritual ancestors who came into being, traveled across the world as they knew it, and left certain marks. And like, for example, the kangaroo man could be seen in like the ridges of a mountain. So it's him like sitting up on his tail and trying to see everything. So that would be their totem. And once they identified with that totem, it was then their duty, they're considered custodians of that animal. So usually if your totem was a kangaroo, you couldn't kill a kangaroo, but you would perform these ceremonies and rituals to ensure that.
Do you have any objection to other people killing kangaroos?
No, that's okay, because it's necessary for survival. But if you look in some of the specific Dreamtime stories, the most common one that's throughout all the different tribes is the rainbow serpent. And one of the dreaming stories is about a little child who won't stop crying, is never happy, and the rainbow serpent comes up and eats him. So it's a story to, you know, tell your child not to be too bossy, essentially. So in that sense, yeah, they were kind of these looming monsters.
I was sort of curious in your discussion about where their law was coming from, which is getting closer to sort of the sense of the course, that it wasn't clear to me who decides either what the true story is or how we interpret it. If you think about one of the problems with Quranic interpretation is you've got this little short description of the Quran, how do we figure out what the generalized legal rule is? And similarly, you've got a story, how do we get a solution to some actual legal problem out of it?
Right. So the elders were the ones who were in charge of passing this down. It was all oral tradition. So in one sense, you can argue that you have this pristine oral record that's kept. And it was very black or white. Everything was dealt with by customary law. So if an ancestral being did something, that was okay. If they didn't, that was wrong. Now the problem comes because of the oral transition and because it was in the hands of people. When, you know, one elder tells the story to the next generation, they might make small changes and things like that. And that's, I think, probably very realistic. And I think it probably adapted to the times. But I did find that in all regards, respect for the elders was tantamount. And if the elders came to a consensus on something, especially a dreaming story or a form of punishment, then that was it, and that was the law. And when you had tribes coming together for different ceremonies, they would often discuss different things like that, but it was all consensus. And within the family unit, it was also consensus.
There's a phrase somewhere from medieval Islamic literature, in nothing are learned men more prone to sin than the invention of traditions.
Sure.
And I'm wondering whether you got a similar pattern where people would say, well, you know, here is this conflict. I want it to go in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
This rule will make it go in that way.
Okay.
So I will slightly change the way I remember this story so that it...
I mean, I could see that, and I would almost assume that's what happened because they were human.
Thank you, Orson. If people think of any more questions for her, you can ask them at the beginning Thursday, and then we'll go on to the next one.